Fred Asner, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And it's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio. On today's edition, 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington in to tell us what to expect for the last few weeks of the Missouri legislative session and what you can do to have your voice heard in the legislature. But last week, citizens from Missouri Association of Social Welfare, Kansas City Justice Task Force, and Missouri Cure all met together at the Capitol Building in Jefferson City. They were there to lobby on a range of bills, from lifting the food stamp ban for citizens with drug convictions to expungement of certain nonviolent offenses to bonding of those releasees who have learned a trade while incarcerated and more. Welcome to Jaws of Justice, Brandon.
How are you doing today, Jeff?
Well, not too bad. Let's jump right into bills because there's a lot of stuff happening down in Jeff City right now. How about House Bill 1402, which would provide bonding for those returning from prison who have learned a marketable skill while they are incarcerated? Well, tell us a little bit about this bill and where it is in the legislature.
First, I'd like to say all praise and glory be to God. It came out of the Corrections Committee last week, 8-0. And again, what it does is it certifies and it bonds inmates. And the reason that this bill is extremely important, it gives somebody that's been locked up a chance to actually reassimilate back into society by giving them life skills and job training while they're in there and allowing them to have the certification. That way they can create their own job when they get out, or they're actually employable when they get out.
Okay, that was Bill 1402, which provides bonding for those folks returning from prison with a marketable skill so that they can actually get a job. Why don't we go to House Bill 1503, which requires the parole board, after 15 years of good behavior, to give a hearing to those who have only one conviction resulting in a life without parole offense.
Now, this bill is a great idea. We're having some problems with the committee that it's in right now. It's in Representative Cox Committee Judiciary. The representative doesn't want to give us a hearing on the bill. And he also had a bill that made a minimal hard 50 when we talk about juvenile offenders, and I said that just to go into the ideology. Now, when we're talking about first-time violent offenders, it's all type of different scenarios that happens in those incidents, and I believe they should be allowed to come up for parole, and it's also various provisions in the bill that stipulate that they can't be causing problems while they're locked up. They pretty much have to be a model citizen. Obviously, that means they're not getting in fights, stabbing people, or anything like that. But you will have certain cases where you have somebody that was 15, 16, that gets a life without parole when they was a juvenile, and then the incidence of the crime wasn't heinous. Now, you have certain individuals that commit heinous crimes, and they continue to commit acts when they locked up in the penitentiary, but those individuals would not qualify underneath this bill to come before the parole board. It would actually be individuals that wasn't causing problems in there, and they also look at the criminal history and the case that happened, and they take all this into account before they come before the parole board.
So in that particular bill, they're not looking for folks to be released after 15 years. So what they want is a hearing so that the parole board can say, all right, this is a person that we should look at again down the road for actual release or whatever, or recommend to the governor for a commutation of the sentence to something less than life without parole.
No, correct. And again, I think it's something extremely important when we look at mandatory sentencing. When we have mandatory sentencing, you can lose somebody for the entirety of their life, and they may have had a chance to actually have been rehabilitated, and they should be allowed to reassimilate into society.
Okay, once again, we're back to House Bill 1407, which sets standards for eyewitness identifications through photo arrays and lineups and how they are conducted by the police, because we know that eyewitness identification is probably one of the worst problems that we have, because they're manipulated quite often. Mm-hmm. And also, our minds take suggestions very well. There's plenty of evidence to this. This is a bill I believe you introduced. Why don't you tell us a little bit about why and where this bill is and whether it has any possibility of getting out?
Well, you kind of hit it right on the head. When we talk about eyewitness identification, they're very subjectable. They're subjectable to the lineup. They're subjectable to the state that the witness was in when the crime was committed and the state that they're in when they're actually going through the eyewitness lineup. This bill was actually something I was working with the Innocent Project on. The Innocent Project is a national project, and they have a lot of scientific data that goes into this bill as far as how do we conduct lineups, where do individuals have to stand, how do individuals look that's going to be next to people with lineups, meaning they have to have like-minded features, which will give a more accurate account when somebody actually singles somebody out in the lineup. And basically what this bill does is standardizes the way eyewitness lineups are conducted from A to Z, meaning the people that's going to be next to the people that's in the lineup, the way the lineup can be conducted, the height of the individuals that would be in the lineup, et cetera. And I believe by standardizing it, we won't see as many false eyewitness hits as we've been having in the past.
You know, one of the things that I know of a particular case that really illustrates this, and that is the eyewitness said that the person was a Hispanic person that had committed the crime, and they were given a photo array. There was only one person mm-hmm. in there that was not even Hispanic, but his picture was darker than the rest of the pictures. And, you know, they basically were told, you know, it's one of these guys.
Yeah.
And they used a picture that made this guy look darker than he actually was. And, of course, that was the person that was picked. And he ended up going to jail for something he didn't do.
The average citizen would be surprised how biased eyewitness lineups are. Now, this bill right here is something that would not necessarily help out defense prosecutors, won't necessarily hurt prosecutors. And going to the cases you just said, a lot of defense attorneys, they wait on lineups because they know they're going to find a loophole somewhere in the lineup, regardless of if their client is guilty or not guilty. This takes that away and it standardizes. So it actually helps out the victim because it doesn't guarantee, but it makes it more solid that when they give their eyewitness testimony that they're actually hitting the perpetrator and not somebody that kind of resembles the perpetrator.
Exactly. House Bill 1700, no person applying for state employment, mm-hmm. public assistance, or state housing can be required to reveal a nonviolent plea or felony conviction. And this has got some exceptions to it. Why don't you explain this bill to us?
Again, this is another one of the public safety bills, and this is actually a perfect mate to House Bill 1402, the certification and binding bill. When we're talking about employment, and when we're talking about housing, and when we're talking about various social service agencies, inmates or those that have been released from the correctional institution, we can do two things with them. We can allow them to reintegrate back into society, or we can create extra barriers that would keep them in the criminal world. When we look at the data from people that have been released, after the first 3 years, the recidivism rate jumps up to 54.4%. And we have to ask ourselves, why is the recidivism rate so high? And then when you talk to those that reoffend, you see the same trends, the same pattern. Well, I couldn't find a house. I couldn't get an apartment. I couldn't get employment. So after a while, I ended up doing the same things that I did before I went to the penitentiary because this is the only thing that I'm allowed to do as criminal activity. So if we really want to have a safe society, we have to ensure those that have been rehabilitated, that have went to a rehabilitation center, is allowed to reintegrate into society. Now, some of the provisions in this bill is for nonviolent felons, not violent felons, but nonviolent felons. And this goes again to the public safety aspect. 80% of the inmates in the state of Missouri are nonviolent drug offenders. Only 23% are violent offenders. So we have a lower segment of the population that we're actively denying housing and employment, and we wonder why they continue to commit crimes.
Well, and this kind of goes with the bill, which I don't have written down, which is the food stamp bill,
yes.
And allowing folks with drug convictions to actually get food stamps, you know, as they're trying to transition into society and you know, find work and you know, make themselves a productive citizen again. And this is something that, you know, food is one of the biggest, to me, especially with young people, is one of the biggest impetuses to, or, you know, ways that people get into crime is mm-hmm. they get hungry mm-hmm. and they got to find some way to feed themselves. And, you know, little kids, they start out in the convenience store with the, you know, the candy bar or the chips or whatever, and this leads to bigger and better things, so to say, or worse things, as you might say. But
no, you're absolutely right. That's how it starts. And when we talk about food, I was trying to look up the bills while you was talking, and I couldn't find the number. It's three bills that you're talking about in the House. I know one Senator Curls is carrying, one Representative Mims is carrying. And I can't remember the Republican that has a bill. I'm a co-sponsor on both of the House bills, but it's utterly ridiculous that somebody can commit multiple murders, get out of the penitentiary, and they can receive all the social services, food stamps, get grants to go to college, go to school, etc. But you have somebody that has a minor drug offense on their record, and they're denied social service benefits, they deny food stamps. But they're still in the same poverty, the boat of poverty. So what do you think they're going to do? I believe that we should have a society in which we're not only punishing people that commit crimes, but we're actually working towards rehabilitating them and creating a safer society. When you actively put people in the boat of poverty and despair, then you actively creating a recipe for chaos and violence.
You know, I want to go to something a little bit different. We have a few more bills that we want to mm-hmm. talk about, but you know, we, like I said, there were a number of folks that went down and lobbied. And why don't you tell us a little bit about what your day's like when you know you have some citizens coming down to lobby and come visit you and see you. How does that change your day at the Capitol?
Well, it gives me a lot of energy because I know, especially with the group you guys brought down there last week, I know when groups like you guys come down there, you're going to actively engage with the other legislators. And you're going to go in their office and you're going to be honest and you're going to talk to them. This helps us out when we talk about getting bills out of the process, out of the committees, out of the floor, et cetera. And it also helps with controlling the conversation and changing perception. When we talk about a lot of the criminal justice issues, we're talking to people that come from more secluded areas than we do. When we talk about inner city areas, so-called urban core areas, or metropolitan areas, or even some suburban areas, when we're looking at more rural areas. So the perception of crime, what constitutes crime and why people commit crimes is different. But when we have people that come up to the state and they lobby and they talk to the representatives, it gives us more leverage to be able to get something done. A perfect example would be House Bill 1402, because I know some of the guys from the groups, some of the guys and women from the groups were calling up there, they was emailing up there. The chair of the committee came to me after the bill was heard in committee and said, "What do you got going on, man? I'm getting so many calls, so many emails." But it showed the need of that bill, which helps out when we go through the negotiation process or when we go through the process of voting it out. But it gives me a lot of energy. It gives me energy because the average legislator, all we see is CEOs, big-time lobbyists. You don't never really see lobbyists from institutions or entities that serve people in need, whether that's low-income areas, criminal justice areas, et cetera.
Is that partially because, you know, most of those groups are not-for-profit and they're also kind of limited to what they can do politically?
I would say it's more or less not the limitations of what they can do politically, but maybe the resources that they have to get people to come back and forth. Some of it could have to do with the non-for-profit status, but I think it's the ability to travel back and forth. But even with that being a realistic fact, we can't use that as an excuse. because the corporations is going to guarantee that they have somebody at that Capitol. They're going to guarantee that when they have an issue come up or when they have a bill that they're fighting for, that they're going to find a way to get people to be up there to lobby on their behalf. When we're talking about the average citizen, we have to do the same thing because we watch our tax dollars get ciphered to large corporations or tax breaks come up or schools funding gets cut or veterans funding gets cut. And we wonder how these large corporations continue to benefit off of taxpayer dollars. Well, if we start showing up and we let these other representatives and politicians know that we're paying attention and we're watching, then we won't see as much money get ciphered out. We'll see more institutions that benefit working class people benefit from people coming up there. We'll see minimum wages raised. We'll see job support raised for the workers as opposed to support for the corporations to victimize the workers grow.
Well, I want to remind everyone, my name is Jeff Humfeld, and I am talking with 22nd District Representative Brandon Ellington, and we're talking about a number of the bills that are in the House and the legislature this year and where they stand, and also, you know, what you can do to have an effect on the outcome of those bills. House Bill 1399. You know, this was a bill I believe that you put forward, but mm-hmm. you've kind of backed away from a little bit because you found a better bill. And this was to remove the sales tax that they started levying in the commissaries within the prisons.
Well, no, 1399 is the one on the guns, but I know exactly.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got the number on it wrong.
No, you're okay. We're talking about both of them. The bill that you're talking about, and I don't have the number in front of me right now. I may find it as I'm talking. The bill that you're talking about will restrict the corrections institutions from charging sales tax on canteen items. My bill was strictly for the state penitentiaries to restrict the sales tax imposed on inmates in the canteen. The bill that you're talking about, I do know the number on that one, is 1666. Sponsored by a Republican. I'm a co-sponsor on that bill. His language was more inclusive than my language. His language went to the county jails, which I was not paying attention to. I didn't know the county jails was charging sales tax to inmates or raising their prices up to compensate for the sales tax. I think it's immoral to charge somebody that's locked up in a correctional institution sales tax when we only pay them $7.50 a month or $8.50 a month on the high end if they have a GED for the type of work that they're doing in there. And the commissary items aren't regular retail prices. If you got to pay $2.30 for toothpaste on the street, you're probably paying closer to $4 in the correctional institution. And now we're going to put sales tax on top of that. That's immoral. And we can't give them any type of certification going back to House Bill 1402. And we're cutting educational services to inmates while they're locked up in the correctional institution. So what are we doing? We're creating a new type of criminal in there that is being victimized by not only the state, but is going to continue to be victimized by society because we haven't given them the type of social skills to be able to make it in the real world. And again, the Republican representative that had the bill, I liked his bill more because it was more inclusive. And now 1399, that's the 1 cent sales tax on ammunition and handgun sales dedicated towards mental health services. So far, I got Republican support on that bill. We're just trying to see what's going to happen with the time frame that we have left. But again, 1399 creates a 1 cent sales tax dedicated towards mental health services.
Okay. Talking about mental health services, you had another bill that you put forward, I believe, which was the gun bill, or is that the one you were just
uh-huh.
speaking
yeah,
of?
Yeah, that was 1399. Yes,
okay. That's where I got the numbers wrong on that. All right, well, let's take a step back, 1 step, 1398, the same day driver's
yes.
license issuance. You know, when you go in to get your license renewed or whatever, evidently they've been backing off of that and you got to wait for it in the mail or some such thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that start? I mean, before you could just go in and you get the license, they take your picture and give it to you.
Well, it started because we're trying to be frugal, trying to be cheap. The federal government, a couple years ago, they came out with new requirements to get your ID. such as the birth certificate, the proof of residency, et cetera. And they also changed some security features in the driver's license. So as opposed to buying a new machine that would allow us to cut driver license the same days using the new security features, we outsourced to a company. Oh, I forgot what state it's in. We outsourced to a company. I want to say it's in the South. I just don't want to mess up the state. We outsourced to a company that has the machines and that can cut the driver's license, but now it takes anywhere between 10 to 45 days, depending on the class of driver's license that you have. The bill that you're talking about, we actually got that out. The original bill was $13.98. I passed it out as an amendment. It's currently over in the Senate right now. We're trying to get it out to Senate. But again, what it would do is take us back to what we used to do by getting the driver's license the exact same day.
Okay, okay. Let's go to 1698, House Bill 1698. This modifies what is considered to be a liquor store as relates to TANF. Why is that important? I mean, we don't want people spending their food stamps in the liquor store, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the major issue. At the state, you have the misperception that people are going to the liquor store and they're taking the EBT cards and they're buying fifths of Hennessy, Cavassier, vodka, and anything else you can use to get drunk. But you can't do that. You currently can't use an EBT card to buy liquor. You can buy food. You can't even buy hot food. So what this does, it puts in statute what a liquor store is. There's currently no state statute that defines what a liquor store is, nor is there a federal statute that defines what a liquor store is. So by creating this bill and making this into law, we're actually going to define the liquor store 85% liquor sales. And this helps out people in low-income areas because you'll have more liquor stores than you will grocery stores. And these liquor stores sell staple foods like milk, eggs, cheese, bread, various kinds of meat, depending on what liquor store that you're in. And I feel that people that are located or isolated inside of a food desert should have the same ability to buy food as opposed to traveling miles to get food.
Okay, I believe we have someone on the line that wants to ask a question here. Caller, are you on the air? Or you're on the air, and what's your name and what part of town are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Donna Wolf. I'm calling from downtown Kansas City. Hi, Representative Ellington. I just had a question for you. Would you please talk about the type of work that inmates are doing in prison and who's benefiting from that? Who's profiting from that? Are they like being subcontracted out to corporations for the work they do? Just let us know what kind of work they're doing that they're getting paid this $7.50 per month for.
Okay, in the state of Missouri, we don't have as many private institutions as some of the other states have, but a lot of the furniture that they built, it gets redistributed to state houses. Ultimately, it can get auctioned off from the state to other entities and stuff like that. We also have them doing everything from creating license plates to cooking to cutting hair, doing various metal work, plumbing work, all type of jobs that would be bondable. And I don't have a list of the jobs in front of me. I wish I did, but going off the list, they have everything from managerial type of jobs that they have to do to the low-end laboring jobs that they have to do from the janitorial work, et cetera. And they pretty much maintain a lot of the institutions and create a lot of the materials that we use in the state. We even have some institutions where they're doing laundry, they're pressing clothes, et cetera, for workers, uniforms, and all type of things. And I wish I had the list in front of me, and I do not have the list in front of me. But they do pretty much everything that you can imagine in the correctional institution. And when we talk about the $7.50 up to the $8.50, they will give somebody $8.50 if they have a GED. $7.50 on the low end, but that's for the totality of the month. If they don't work, they don't get any money. But they're still required to provide or to pay for commissary items, to get commissary items, et cetera, which would be toothpaste, toothbrushes, hygiene products. We're not talking about anything elaborate. We're talking about basic necessity items here that we're requiring inmates to work for and then to pay for while we benefit off of them. And we're also talking about a large cash cow when we talk about the various contracts that the correctional institutions receive. They have five or six different food contracts, phone contracts. These are dollars that do not go back to the General Assembly. These are dollars that stay with the correctional institutions as well as the canteen money. The canteen money stays with the correctional institutions. It does not go back to the state, to the general revenue. We allocate almost $1 billion to them to maintain the penitentiaries. And then depending on the institution that you're in, we're talking about millions of dollars that they generate off the inmates at that correctional institution that stays with that correctional institution, and the correctional institution fails to provide educational alternatives. They fail to provide job training services or GED services or life skill services. When we talk about rehabilitation, the word rehabilitate means to restore to useful nature. But what we're doing with our correctional institution is warehousing and benefiting off of the dollars of the inmate's family and the inmate themselves. And I wish I had an entire list, because if I read through the list, it'd be kind of shocking. All the work they do, from they even train animals in there, depending on the correctional institution that you're in. I mean, it's mind blowing how. Okay, I'm sorry. It's mind-blowing how many jobs they have.
All right. Thank you. We thank you very much, caller, but our time is up. We got just a little bit more information, a contact information to get out, and then we're going to have to go on to our next subject. The new Missouri website is mo.gov, basically, and if you're trying to get a hold of that, that's basically the executive branch.
Yeah.
I think if
you're
trying,
the governors.
Yeah, if you're trying to get to somebody in the House, it's house.mo.gov, and in the Senate, it's senate.mo.gov. So they've standardized it, makes it a little bit easier. You have any phone numbers or anything else that you want to give out?
Yeah, my phone number is 573-751-3129. And again, with that website that you gave out, that's house.mo.gov. And I would like to ask people to go there. You can actually listen to live debates when we're on the floor debating. And you can actually go to the Secretary of State website, and you can pull up old floor debate, and you can actually hear what people are really saying and what they're really fighting for.
Okie doke. Well, I want to thank Representative Ellington for being here today. This is Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. We will take a break for some announcements and maybe a little bit of music. And when we return, Jessica will have her guest, Abby Rowe. Care of.
You're listening to the Jaws of Justice here on Kansas City Community Radio, 90.1 FM, KKFI. Joining me on the phone, Abby Rowe. Abby's coming into Kansas City. Well, Abby, are you there? Good morning.
Yeah, I'm here. How are you doing?
Yay! How are you today, dear?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for asking.
Awesome. Abby is a former resident of Missouri and what we refer to now as a political refugee. You are, you've moved to Colorado to get access to the medicine that you need. And
yes, I have.
I'm sorry. There we go. We got you. Yeah, so Abby's moved to Colorado to get the access to the medicine that she needs. First, let me let our listeners know, just why don't you let our listeners know a little bit about what you're dealing with and why you moved to Colorado.
Absolutely. I have a musculoskeletal disease, that is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and what it does is it affects the connective tissue in my body so that my skeleton isn't held together properly, and my muscles actually compensate. So I deal with frequent joint dislocation and subluxation, and I also deal with chronic muscle fatigue, as well as a whole list of other symptoms that go with.
And pain, I imagine, from the injuries as well that are caused by it.
So, severe pain from the joint dislocation and just the muscle fatigue. So the littlest thing is like a major workout for me.
So this is a genetic disorder for you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS is how it's better known.
So you've had this your entire life, and this is something that you've been going through since you were born, and then your parents have been dealing with it with you as well. Now that you're a young adult, how has that affected your relationship with your parents, do you think? I mean, having to go through being that basically the medical community hasn't known what to do with you and has been basically using you kind of as a guinea pig for a lot of things. How would you say that that has affected your relationship with your parents going through medical and this medical kind of a nightmare for you? And what are your parents on board with your cannabis choices now for treatment?
You know what? My mom is very, very supportive. She was really hesitant at first, like most people are, and really reserved about it. But once she saw how I was after treating my disease with cannabis versus all of the really harsh pharmaceuticals they've been putting me on, she couldn't deny the amount of energy I had. She even commented on my endurance. Specifically the first weekend that I went back to St. Louis to spend with her. She was totally on board from that moment on. My father, on the other hand, struggles significantly, and he and I don't even have a relationship right now because of it.
It's sad, but it happens. Do you... You know, I know there's probably a lot of kids that are actually seeking asylum from or emancipation from their parents because of, you know, not agreeing with the medical treatment. What would you say to someone that is in that position?
You know, I would tell them that that social construction is really powerful, and that cannabis has been criminalized for many, many, many years, and that's something that's really hard to overcome. But that when they look at what doctors and pharmaceuticals are putting into their children's bodies and how that's going to affect them long term versus them using a flower, you know, I just think when you put it in that perspective, we're talking about harsh synthetic drugs that have a lot of really dangerous side effects, and taking more drugs just to deal with the side effects of the first one. And that when you're talking about cannabis, you're talking about a flower. You're talking about a dried flower, and there are so many ways of ingesting it, edibles and tea and vaporizers. There's a lot of really medicinal ways to ingest and use the cannabis plant. And I've never had any negative side effects from it. I mean, when I was in Missouri, just from the medications they were using to treat my pain, there's not really a way to treat my disease. I was throwing up every day, all day, and I was not eating meals with friends or family, or eating at all. And I was hospitalized for my weight and dehydration, and a bunch of other things. And since I've been to Colorado and switched to cannabis, to this holistic treatment, I have thrown up once, and I've been here for 9 months now. And if anyone had ever told me that that would change or that my life would change so dramatically, I never would have believed them, but it absolutely has.
So do you see a large population of refugees coming into Colorado right now?
Well, you know, Denver is a unique place because it's really hard to find a native in Denver because there are so many people that have, you know, transferred from all over the country. So I run into a lot of people that have moved specifically just for access to medical, or they've moved because they have a family member or child who needs access to medical.
How do you find the atmosphere as far as, now this is mainstream for them, and I know that the rest of the country is really watching closely. Most politicians are watching because of the dollar signs that they're missing and keeping track of how much money they could have had. But, you know, as we know, there is a lot to this that's not money, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you seeing this coming out? I mean, I know there's, like I said, there's a lot of people that are moving. There's a whole kind of a culture of refugees, as it were. But I can almost picture you with your little backpack, you know, homeless and everything. But is there a situation set up so people know that, you know, they really need to do their research before they just head out there and think that, you know, this is, I mean, it's a great place for them to be. It's legal, so it takes off that pressure and worry. But is there some amount of research? What could you tell a listener who needs to flee for safety reasons and for medical purposes?
I would tell them to not to make sure to do their research as far as when they get here, to make sure that they have a doctor or they've been able to find one of the medical groups who are writing the prescription so that they can get their red card as soon as they're out here. But to know that there are a lot of fees associated with getting your red card, the processing fees, the doctor fees, it's taxed really heavily at that point. If you're moving out here and you're not looking to get a red card, rec is really, really high and expensive. So it's not something that you could affordably use medicinally without a red card, because your red card does give you it's like a tax-free card. You're not paying the extra 35%, and you have way more products available to you. I'd also say to make sure that they have a realistic idea of the cost of living, because somebody who's lived in St. Louis and Columbia, and I have a lot of friends in Kansas City, the cost of living out here is a lot more. There's a dramatic difference between the cost of living back home and here in Denver.
I know, kind of getting off the subject just a little tiny bit, but there's another group that works with teens in recovery, and they were kind of aghast at the thought of doing a show back-to-back with a show that I was doing, which was an update as to all the legislation that's happening, and this was maybe a month or so ago. But they were not really wanting to be backside of my show or the second half of the hour because they felt it was very detrimental. They'd heard from other kids that this whole process is kind of what brought to Colorado drug problems on top of it. So it kind of like a free-for-all. My response to them was, if that is the fact, if it's kind of a Haight-Ashbury happening in Denver, then maybe that needs to be addressed as well. I mean, people need to know. Is that happening? Do you see that abuse or, you know, a Haight-Ashbury scene kind of breaking out?
No, you know what? I don't at all. Everything is really surprisingly low-key. You know, regulation is taken so seriously out here, and you see stores that aren't legitimate disappear like that, and the ones that are stick around. So it's not conducive to the drug culture that you typically think of when you're thinking of marijuana and things. It's really not like that at all.
Do you see sources or services for addiction being offered just as much as you would, say, the legal cannabis? Is there that resource available?
There are a ton of programs available out here for people that are suffering from addiction or dealing with different addictions. So I would say that it's a great place to come and seek treatment because of all the access.
I know it sounds counterintuitive to maybe to a person who doesn't realize what the cannabis oil can do, but actually research shows that the oil can really helps with withdrawal and the recovery process.
The oil is amazing. It's one of the big lifesavers for me personally, because you can cook with it, you can use it topically, and you can also use it as a vapor and inhale it. And it has kept me from going into withdrawal before, when I've not been able to have access to medication.
You've been going through, I mean, you've had this, your syndrome as long as you've been alive. So I think you were telling me that you had figured you'd had close to a quarter million oxycodones in your career of having pain management.
Yeah, I started pain management when I was 11 or 12 years old, and I'm 26 today, and this has been the last nine months is the first time I've not been using those prescription medications, and it's ridiculous. I don't look like a skeleton anymore. I don't have dark circles under my eyes. My weight is up. It's remarkable.
I don't know
if that answered your question. I'm sorry.
We kind of get lost on these conversations. They all kind of go together. I think that I have a caller here. Let me see if I can snatch them up and see if she wants to talk. Nope, we didn't. We got them on there, but not quick enough. I think they may have been calling to ask you a question, perhaps, but we lost that. But, Abby, you're coming in this week to testify. What's going on? Or are you just speaking?
I'm coming in tomorrow. I'm flying in and making my way to Jeff City for Wednesday because Wednesday is lobby day. So it's an opportunity to talk to all the lobbyists and legislators down at the Capitol. So it's a really big day for activists to go down and get their message out and talk to the people who represent them in Congress.
When you say a lobby day, is this specifically for cannabis-related issues, or are there a lot of other issues going on as well?
There are a lot of other issues going on. So lobby day is just an opportunity to make our lobbyists and legislators accessible so that we can talk to them about issues going on. I actually did testify. I was not able to fly in to be there in person, but Show Me State Cannabis drew up this awesome flyer, had my story on it, and it had pictures from before my move to a state with medical access and pictures of after. And that was handed out in place of my personal testimony.
So in allowing, so they are allowing public testimony at this point tomorrow? I mean, it will be Wednesday. I'm sorry.
No, on Wednesday it'll be more like going around and talking to everyone and making sure that they have a clear understanding of what we mean when we say medical and what we're looking for and what patients are looking for, as far as safety access and access, and make sure that they don't have any miscomprehensions about what we're looking for, what's happening in the states that do have access.
And I know there was I do believe that we just recently, and within the last week, passed a hemp ordinance, that we did get industrial hemp as well.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, as well as a medical hemp, which there is two difference. There is a difference, of course, the hemp being, besides it's an industrial and everything can be made out of it, but also they extract what's called a CBD, which is kind of what Dr. Gupta has made mainstream more or less for the public to understand the plant Charlotte's Web. And how that is helpful to brain disorders, epilepsy, based illnesses, or perhaps even MS, or anything that's around lesions or brain is very, very much helped by the CBDs in a hemp plant, which are not psychoactive. But I do believe that we did just get a pass to push that out there.
That's amazing. I can speak to that because there's one of the patients at my clinic is actually 3 years old and has severe seizures, and they're wanting to do open brain surgery to try to treat the seizures and get them to stop. And there were a lot of risks associated with that, and the parents were really wanting to try every alternative that they could find before they, cut their son's head open. And they have him using medical cannabis, specifically the CBDs that you were talking about, and they've found that it's treating his condition completely.
I'd heard that there was a stipulation saying that they had to have failed
or attempted three other sources of treatment. I'm not sure what the facts are on that because I myself did not get an opportunity to read this. I know there was a real lot of action going on around the CBDs. And it is really touted as, like, you know, miraculous, but it's something that's actually been around for hundreds of thousands of years.
Right. I actually don't know what the current law is on or what the regulation is for. You have to try a certain number of medical interventions before you're allowed to seek medicinal cannabis for children. So I can't speak to that currently, but I think that makes sense.
Well, we get to the medical, you know, Western medicine, and I think that they're just discovering that, you know, and it's kind of myself as well, kind of look to the past to see what we had before we started adding all the, you know, wonderful new modern technology and things to it. And it seems that, you know, going back to the basics to treat things is really seems to bear a lot of common sense.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that a flower doesn't stress out your body nearly the way that the synthetic drugs that they have out there, especially when you're talking about pain management. Most pain medications are chocked full of acetaminophen, and acetaminophen destroys your liver and kidneys. And I can't speak to all states, but some states add the acetaminophen so it's not considered a street drug, thinking that if we add the Tylenol essentially to this pain medication, people won't be able to abuse it because it will result in an overdose or in liver failure. So there's what that creates is for patients like me, we don't have a choice but to put all of this acetaminophen into our body when we're treating our pain, because that's the only form that we have any kind of pain intervention coming in. And that's why cannabis is so huge, is because you're talking about something natural, and you're talking about taking away all of those really, really harsh synthetic drugs that your body can't process. And I was watching my body break down just because of the buildup of all of those things in my body. It was unreal, the difference switching over. I mean, it makes sense when you think about it holistically, but it still has been unreal, the difference.
And I'm so happy that you found something that's working for you. And I'm really looking forward to seeing you when you come into town, and let our listeners know, because we got to wrap it up. That's how fast that time goes. But thank you so much for calling in today, Abby.
Thanks for having me.
And maybe let our listeners know, that this would be a time for you as well to go down. And if you're wanting to get involved, Jeff City, go down and get to know your lobbyists, and maybe catch a few people in their office and explain to them what it is and why we need it. But Abby, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me on Justice this morning.
Thank you.
We're looking forward to seeing you this week. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds great. Have a good one.
Yeah, thanks so much, Abby. Bye-bye. You're listening to the Jaws of Justice on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Jessica Thomas. My guest, Abby Rowe, will be in to testify and made it heard about the good word of medical cannabis in Jefferson City. We're highly encouraging you to get up to Jefferson City and get involved. If this is not your issue, pick one that is important to you and get involved, as it matters to all of us. Coming up here on Jaws of Justice, we're going to wrap up the show for the day, and we'll be back again next week with more awesomeness.
Ready? One, two. Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know, maybe I'm supposed to cry. If nobody ever knows the way I feel, that's all right.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcasts on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We thank our engineer Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Clemmer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Friday. Up next is Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Echo Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musical.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
My name is Al Byrne. I'm the co-founder and COO of educational charity, a national educational nonprofit called Patients Out of Time. We're also a Virginia corporation, and we were formed in the spring, actually April. This is April I'm speaking to you now, April of 1995, 19 years ago. And our mission over the course of all these years has been the education of healthcare professionals in the United States about the therapeutic and clinical uses of cannabis. And I'm happy to report that when we started this mission back in the early 90s, even before we incorporated, the average American, about 15 to 20% of America, the citizens of America, thought that cannabis was actually had medical value. Now it's completely flipped. Now we've got 85% of the American public thinks it has medical value, and 15% is still back in the dark ages.
Al, I know you served our country in the military. What was your rank?
Well, I served for 24 years, actually, Dean. I joined the Navy when I was 17 years old as a midshipman at the University of Notre Dame. And I retired at the age of 41 as a lieutenant commander. I have post-traumatic stress. I have injuries from Vietnam and other places. I hurt. I use cannabis to control my pain. Don't take it away, but it sure as hell helps. And the use of for post-traumatic stress for me is dramatic. It keeps my life in balance. And if I may go on with the subject of the military, as you may know or may not know, listeners, 22 American servicemen, men and women, and we're counting all wars, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, the recent Afghan-Iraq debacle, all of these veterans, 22 a day commit suicide. That's one every 65 minutes, basically one an hour. So while you're listening to this radio show, some grunt somewhere just killed himself. To alleviate this problem, cannabis is necessary. It's not maybe. It's we got to have this in the military pharmacopoeia.
Once again, that was Al Byrne of Patients Out of Time. They're having a major conference in Portland on May 8th through May 10th. You can learn more at medicalcannabis.com. We do indeed have to find a better medicine to take care of our returning veterans. Dean Becker, DrugTruth.net.